just let me know. All right. Well, good morning, everyone. It is 9:32 a.m. on Friday, October 16th, 2020. This is an informal hearing on case number PU-20-344, transmission cost adjustment rate for Montana-Dakota Utility. I'm Commissioner Brian Crosius, joined by Commissioner Julie Fedorchek and Commissioner Randy Chrisman. And as I mentioned prior to the proceeding officially starting, Commissioner Chrisman is dialing in remotely. We're doing that in an effort to create the proper distance here at the commission as we go through the hearing and the proceeding today. This, again, is an informal hearing, and it is related to the transmission cost adjustment rate. And I'm going to give just a few points on what this is, because it's a little different format. I see we have some people who have called in. But we're going to go through the informal hearing, and then we're going to follow the informal with a public input session. And then potentially, depending on what may be asked or comments made during the public input portion, we may go back to the company to get some answers or to have them provide additional information. But we'll see what transpires during that portion of the informal. This is an annual filing that the company is required to make, and I think that's an important point. I've had some calls from the press and some visits from the press, and I think the information provided has been accurate, but I think there are also some missing components that the public needs to realize. This is an annual filing. This goes back to legislation that was passed in 2007 by the state legislature, which created a mechanism to develop riders. And what's a rider if you're a general member of the public? It's one component of a utility bill. There are three riders. There are a renewable rider that we consider that currently is evaluated. There is a generation rider. And then there is also a transmission rider. Today we're going to be talking about what MDU is seeking on their transmission rider. But again, this is a required filing that the company has to make every year, which they did. And, of course, it's generated some conversation because it is different in terms of how riders have gone over the past 5 years. And this will lead into one of the questions that I have. But just for a point of reference, in 2016, there was no change. Excuse me, no change to this rider. In 2017, I believe it increased by 99 cents a month, followed in by a decrease of 69 cents per month in 2018, an increase in 2019 of 25 cents, but then 2020 is certainly an outlier with an increase proposed of $3.35. So in the preceding 4 years, the average change was 14 cents a month. And this is due to transmission upgrades, things that are deemed necessary to make sure that we have an adequate supply of power delivered to homes and businesses when it's 100 degrees out in July or it's 30 below in January. So, but again, the company is going to have to make their case and explain why this is more significant in nature. And I've got a number of questions that I'll probably reserve until we get through the presentation itself. But one final point, again, we're doing this a little bit differently, and it's unique in the sense that we're going to take public input. We typically don't do that in an informal hearing. We meet with the company, we work with staff, we come up with what we think is a good decision and in the best interest of the public. So this one's about balancing costs with reliability and some other factors that will be discussed. But no entity requested a formal hearing. I want to make that point very clear. We offered that through a notice of opportunity for hearing. We did not receive any request for a formal hearing. We also did not receive a request from any entity in terms of asking for intervener status. So the parties to the hearing would be the utility and then the commission. And again, the public input session is because we recognize that what is being proposed, and this originated at the commission, that we should take public input as a part of this process. So I look forward to that portion of it. So we'll go through the informal hearing. Then we'll get to the public input session, as mentioned. And then we will see if some additional information will be asked of the company or anything else that might result. But I look forward to that portion. But that would conclude my opening comments. And because this is a little different, we've typically interjected when we've had questions, and that will probably be the way we'll conduct the informal as it goes through. And don't mistake, for those listening, the word informal. The review is just as strenuous. It's just as rigorous as a formal hearing. It's just a different setting in terms of how the hearing is conducted, but no less rigorous in nature. So with that, Commissioner Fedorchuk, any opening comments?
Sure. Thank you, Commissioner Cautious. And first, I want to thank you for your leadership on this issue in trying to find a way to do what we need to do in terms of reviewing the application, but also allowing for public input, since we knew that there's a lot of interest in this case, and really an opportunity to learn a little bit more for everybody about this particular mechanism, this transmission rider, and all of the various rules, regulations, and procedures that govern our review of a transmission rider, and then the difference between an informal and formal. I think that's in terms of a hearing. I like the informal because it allows for more of a give and take and less swearing in, and no administrative law judge. It's a little bit more of a free flow of conversation between us and the parties. So I think that's the benefit of the informal process. Of course, we can always kick it to a formal process if need be, and that is one of the tools at our disposal. So appreciate that. I just, in addition to the comments that you provided about what's driving this and the state law that allows for these riders, I wanted to just call out that I I do at some point would like either the company or our staff to talk about some of the federal law that governs excuse me, I've got a frog in my throat, a federal law that also comes to play here in terms of whether it's the Federal Power Act or I don't know exactly which federal law impacts the state's jurisdiction on interstate power transfers. But it's my understanding that there are some federal laws at play here that also regulate how much involvement the state can have in terms of saying yes or no to charges for interstate power transfers, which is largely what the MISO charges are. Those are, and that's a bulk of the projects included or the costs included in this rider. So I think that's important information to put on the table. And so if anybody, whether from the company or our staff, is able to enlighten myself and others on that issue, I would appreciate that. Otherwise, looking forward to a good conversation today.
Okay, thank you very much. Commissioner Christman, opening comments?
I'll just add two things. Commissioner Fedorchuk's frog in her throat is probably easily explainable because her awesome son Sam and the rest of his St. Mary Saint teammates had such an excellent performance last night on the football field. So congratulations to them. And getting back to the rider thing, just one more thing so that people who are going to participate in the input session later that are listening now to maybe help make it more sensible. One of the reasons for riders is that in this kind of odd world of regulated utilities, a regular rate case is a very intense and thorough process that ends up costing the company and ultimately the ratepayers and even the taxpayers on our end a lot of money. And so you don't want those happening frequently. So in between the rate cases, some of these things that are very unpredictable when you're doing a rate case, we've built in this rider system where these can be adjusted without a full-blown rate case. And so just to help people better understand why you have your rate and then a side or rider, that some of these things you just need to review a little more frequently than you do a full rate case. Other than that, just looking forward to hearing from the company, from our staff, and then later from the public.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask a quick question?
Go ahead.
Was there a time, did you set any sort of a time frame on today's discussion and today's hearing?
No. If I had to estimate, I would imagine the presentation will take less than 30 to 40 minutes, depending on if we ask questions along the way, or if we wait until the presentation is done. Then we'll get into the question and answer portion, the commission and the company. I would anticipate between 11 and 11:30 in terms of when we would begin to take public input, if that's an estimate. I don't think it would be later than, say, several hours from now. So I think that's probably about the best estimate I can give. One thing I do want to mention, that this is an informal hearing involving only undisputed facts. If there are any disputed facts, we will close the hearing and issue a notice of hearing at that point in time if anything should be disputed. So with that said, we have two other members of the staff that are in the room, and I believe we have at least one on the phone as well. Could you introduce yourselves, Victor and Brian?
Victor Shook with advisory staff.
Brian Johnson with legal.
Okay, and then do we have any other members of staff that you're aware of that are participating?
I would assume our general counsel, Jack Hsu, is listening.
Right.
Likely at least a couple more as well.
Yeah. So Jack Hsu may or may not be involved. And then Travis, or Darcy, or whomever from the company would like to make the introductions of who you have on the call.
We'll lead that off, but could we get the presentation on the screen?
Sure. I can put it up, or if you want, I can make you the presenter, and then you can share it from your end, and then you're free to click through it, and control it at your own speed. I'll leave that up to you.
Okay. That would work.
Right. And again, prior to beginning the presentation, just identify the team members you have on the call.
Yep. Good morning, commissioners. This is Carl Liebitz, Assistant General Counsel with MBU Resources. Also joining us while Travis is getting the PowerPoint up, we do have Travis Jacobson, Director of Regulatory Affairs, Nathan Benson, Regulatory Analyst with the company, Robert Frank, Director of Electric Transmission Engineering, and Darcy Nigam, Director of Electric Systems Operations and Planning, all with the company and either participating or available to answer questions as we go throughout the hearing today. It looks like we do have the PowerPoint up, and so we can dive in. So as you outlined, Commissioner, the Montana Dakota did file its annual update to the transmission cost adjustment rate on July 17th, 2020, as required by the tariff to do an annual filing. The filing does request $15,522,947 to be collected, which reflects a projected July 2020 to June 2021 revenue requirement and a true up of actual costs and revenues through May of 2020. The proposed effective date to implement the adjusted rate would be November 1 of 2020. And as we will demonstrate today, the investments and associated costs qualify for recovery. The proposed rates do comply with the tariff and are just and reasonable. And for that reason, we're asking that the commission approve the company's annual filing and update to the transmission cost adjustment rate as filed. So with that, we can probably move to the next slide, and Travis will lead us from here.
Thank you, Carl. Good morning, commissioners. Thanks for the opportunity to present. Just getting into a little bit of the details, the costs that we currently recover through the transmission cost adjustment rider, we really have three buckets, if you will. The transmission-related costs associated with the RTOs that were mentioned earlier. We have costs from both MISO and SPP, and we also have revenue credits in both of those as well. So what we have in our rider is the net expense of those RTO charges. The second bucket, if you will, is the cost related to transmission projects. Since our last case was filed, we've had a number of fairly large transmission projects that Rob Frank will talk about. And so that then the final bucket is the true up of the prior year's under recovered balance. And I'll get into that just a little bit more as well. So now putting dollars to those buckets, you'll see that our net MISO and SPP expense is approximately $10.5 million. Projects that we included in our previously filed rider, the transmission projects there, about $2.3 million. We have additional projects in that are being worked on now or are currently in place, and we're not in the last rider, of about $1.1 million. And then the under-recovered balance. And you'll see the variances from the prior year's filing, and you'll see that the largest item there is the MISO expenses. And in our previous filing, we understated the charge. So to Commissioner Krosh's question about why the big increase, the primary driver is related to the net MISO expenses, net MISO and SPP, I should say. And Darcy will talk about those charges here in just a second. But we underestimated what we had thought we would collect, or be charged, I should say. So that decreased our collections last year, and that's the main driver. You'll see that our expenses of the $10.5 million are really going to be in line with what we incurred in the last rider. So you'll see that the $2.5 million is really what's pushing into our over and under recovered balance. And finally, a residential customer using, you know, just under 900 kWh a month would see the increase that was mentioned earlier of about $3.35. Or about $40.20 on an annual basis. So I'll move to the next slide, and Darcy will take over here.
Yeah, Darcy, you might get into this, but just so you can address two questions that I have, it sounds like the first, you might already be doing this, but just how predictable are the charges, or unpredictable might be a better way of putting it, from MISO? And then secondly, on the under-recovered balance, that ties back to forecasting. If you can just address that as you're talking about that number as well. You know, the MISO is a $2.4 million and change variance, but the under-recovered balance was just over $2 million, which would indicate a sizable miss on the forecasting side. So just to frame that up, if you could answer that as you go through those two things.
Okay. Thank you, commissioners. Good morning. My name is Darcy Nigam. I'm going to talk a little bit more in detail as far as the transmission cost adjustment inputs, at least for the MISO and SPP charges, and also the revenues that are recovered through the TCA. When we talk about MISO and Southwest Power Pool, they're regional transmission organizations. They do span multiple states. In the case of MISO, it does cover a 15-state area and one Canadian province. And because there's commerce that goes across state lines, interstate, those tariffs, and at least the rates that we pay to MISO and also Southwest Power Pool, are governed by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission through the Federal Power Act. So from the standpoint of our participation in the regional transmission organizations, which have significant benefits for our customers versus not being in a regional transmission organization, these costs that we're talking about as far as the rates that we pay to MISO Southwest Power Pool are established and approved by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And through these proceedings, particularly the transmission cost adjustment rate that we're talking about, is the way that we recover those back through customers, at least in our state rates that we charge. So taking a look at
Darcy,
the slide.
Excuse me, Darcy, this is Julie. If you could just stop right there, because I want to kind of underscore that point, because that gets to one of the questions I was asking at the beginning. When you say that those tariffs and rates that govern those charges for MISO and SPP are set and established by the FERC, can you just take that one step further and talk about what your understanding is of our ability to, as the State Commission, to object to those rates or say today, or in this case, we're not going to pay them or we don't want you to pay those rates?
So from the standpoint of the regional transmission organizations, you know, that there are early stakeholder groups and members that do participate, at least give input, you know, at least to the RTOs on how tariffs may be developed and changes. You know, all of those stakeholders, including, you know, the state public service commissions, have opportunities, you know, to object to anything that comes out of the tariff with FERC, but FERC ultimately has that decision, at least in what those rates are. You know, from that standpoint, you know, as a member who takes service from the regional transmission organizations, you know, we are charged those rates. And so they are approved and we are charged those. And through the mechanisms that we're talking about, the TCA is that recovery. So if there's some way that these charges are just approved, it isn't that we can't, that we don't pay these costs or charges, at least to the RTOs. At least it would create a gap, you know, between, you know, what we're charged or credits that we received and as far as how those flow through our customers.
That helps.
You know, for door check,
it does. I just, to say that we would, our opportunity as a commission would be to weigh in with the RTOs when they're establishing those rates and try to influence them, then object to FERC if we had a strong objection to the rates that are established. And then if we disallowed you from recovering those rates, I'm assuming, him, you would probably object to that and have a fairly strong case to take against us. I'm just kind of trying to play this through in terms of the mechanics of this particular tariff and who's in control of it.
Thank you, Commissioner Fedorchuk, for the additional comments. When we look at this slide, I want to just talk about the couple buckets that make up at least the transmission-related charges. And again, these are transmission-related services, you know, either that MDU takes from the regional transmission organizations or revenues credits that we receive, at least through some of those same tariff mechanisms. When we take a look at this, the first part of this is revenues and credits. The first line in there is facility sharing, which is an agreement we have with Basin Electric, just on how they take service for use of some of our lower voltage transmission facilities that we did not get credits. And I'll talk about credits when we get in the SPP line for use of those facilities by an SPP member. And a lot of that is just driven by the voltage they have and as far as how the the facility, those facilities are configured on our system. We talk about revenues from MISO. These are revenues that we receive from MISO as they provide services to other for our transmission system, either for customers like Basin Electric who use our facilities and do take MISO transmission service, or they're governed by other transmission customer service across the MISO total footprint, 15 state area, that we do receive revenues for. And those are generally called the point-to-point transmission revenues. And also the revenues we receive are if we have any specific cost allocated projects that do fall into a certain schedule in this case. As we've seen, both of those have been fairly consistent, at least the basin facility charges. The MISO one does have an impact as far as we've seen some load that Basin Electric has moved some of their customer load off our system. And part of that has been as their members have built out their own facilities. We've seen them taking less MISO transmission service from us. And also we see, at least in the Schedule 26, which are some of these projects in MISO that we're able to cost allocate to others. As those projects are in life, we do see that their net remaining book, you know, value has gone, that does go down over time, so we collect less revenue. From the standpoint of Southwest Power Pool, we're a MISO transmission owner, but because Western Area Administration and Basin Electric joined a different regional transmission organization in 2015, we do take Southwest Power Pool transmission for use of their facilities that we used to have prior arrangements for. As part of that arrangement, we do receive, for service that we take, we do receive revenue credits back, and those revenue credits back are an offset to our transmission bill, or the charges line below that we would end up having. We would end up seeing the value of those revenue credits in the current filing is at $8.4 million as compared to $10.3 million last year. Those credit amounts do change, you know, every year based upon the agreed upon calculation that we do have in a settlement with the parties and also the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission over time. One comment I would make, at least on those revenue credits, last week we did have a settlement with Southwest Power Pool and the other transmission owners in the area of how we would be able to receive additional credits in the future. And also as far as what the approval for those would look like. And that was a big win in our standpoint, and we think that will continue to provide us additional revenue credits similar to what the prior filing amounts were, at least going forward. So we take a look at the total revenues and credits, at least the difference between the prior filing and this one is about $2.7 million. The allocation in North Dakota is about $1.9 million. And the largest part of that, as I talked about, does deal with these revenue credits that we get from Southwest Power Pool in the line for SPP.
Darcy, when I'm looking at the numbers, would it be fair to say that the actual charges from MISO and SPP, they increase, but as one might expect due to inflationary factors, et cetera, it wasn't, how do I want to frame this up? They increased a little bit, not that the numbers are small, but proportionately as a percentage, they increased a little bit, and it wasn't so much an increase from MISO or SPP, but just underestimating the actual charges in the previous filing. Is that correct? Because we've got an under-collected balance of under-recovered balance of $2 million, and then really when I look at the variance of 2.4 from MISO and SPP, that was driven by underestimating those charges as well. Is that correct?
It would be. It would be the largest, I think the variance drivers are the credit amount, you know, that we receive from SPP. And then the other one is at least on the transmission rate that Southwest Power Pool charges us for use of their facilities. And that would be in the total charges below.
Okay, so another way of putting it, it isn't that the charges from MISO and SPP increased by $2.4 million. They increased by $657,000. So a quarter of it was because of an increase, actual increase from the RTOs, regional transmission organizations. But three quarters of it was just underestimating what those amounts would be in the prior filing, correct?
Yes, and that would be largely in that the revenues, the credits we received, not from the services we're billed for from Southwest Power Pool, and that would deal on those revenues or facility credits that I mentioned as far as for Southwest Power Pool to use those facilities of ours to charge services to others.
Yeah. How predictable are those credits? It would appear that they're not.
So the credits, as we've seen on those, it does deal with using a formula rate. And again, that formula rate has other inputs to it. We've seen some of those have been impacted by changes in corporate income tax rates and also on returns that were allowed to be charged from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, at least for use of those facilities. And both of those over the past couple of years have had a driver to drive down transmission revenue requirements, which would reduce this amount of facility credits we receive from Southwest Power Pool. As I did mention, at least this FERC settlement that we have last week that we filed, I do believe that will have at least help as in a stabilizing mechanism and be able to in the future return those credit levels back similar to what we historically have seen.
I have a question. Darcy, just to follow up a little bit with that. So in a nutshell, the final cost to ratepayers for these transmission services from the MISO and SPP is the net between the money you earn from people using your facilities, those are the revenue credits, and the amount you have to pay to use the facilities, and the net of that, whether it's positive or negative, gets charged back to your customers. Is that accurate? Just in a simplest term. Okay, so I'm curious. I understand. I just want a simpler explanation, if you can. Why were you guys so off in estimating your revenues? I mean, that's a $1.9 million, almost $2 million swing in 1 year. So, did something change that you didn't anticipate suddenly, or why are your revenue credits from SPP, why was your estimate so off?
So we started taking transmission service from Southwest Power Pool in the end of 2015, and we've had a mechanism we've used since then to estimate and to forecast what these charges will be and what the offsetting revenues or credits will be. You know, in that process has worked well for us. We ended up with a bit of an anomaly this past year, I would say, just because our mechanism we've used to forecast these has been a continuation, at least what the current rate has been for the coming period. And some of that just deals with we don't know what the SPP transmission charge is until we get our bill come January 1. So we kind of assume that the rates that we're paying and we know the billable quantities, we can make adjustments and kind of forecast that going forward is saying we'll continue to pay the existing rates plus the future ones based upon the current charges. And we've done a similar thing and it's worked really, really well as far as on the revenue credits. And we ended up, I would say, have a bit of anomaly that happened this particular year where they came in this case, you know, it's $2 million less of looking at the prior filing to what the current filing is. And I would say some of those reasons for that adjustment or reduction from 10.3 to 8.3 are things we'll be able to correct going forward in this settlement that I talked about with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And we should see in the future that we're back into a more, I would say, stable and predictable amount for those credits.
Okay. Then just as a quick follow-up to that, and I don't want to belabor this too much, but it is kind of the heart of the one of the biggest increases here in the rates. In your application on page 4, it says that Montana, Dakota's experienced a decrease in SPP facility credits driven by a lower ratio of the transmission requirement to the total revenue requirement. Okay, that's, I think, what you were just talking about. We talked about, but as well as a reduction in Montana, Dakota's transmission assets required to serve SPP customers and therefore no longer qualifying for facility credits. So that to me is more troublesome or problematic, or I'm more concerned about that because it suggests to me that that would be a permanent thing if they don't need your transmission assets anymore because they built their own. Then you're not going to get revenue from those anymore. Am I reading too much into that line? That seems different from what you just described.
Well, so when we talk about the SPP credits, again, it goes back to their tariff, again, of what qualifies for facilities. We do have, as I mentioned before, at least on Basin's customers, you know, taking less transmission service directly from us and building their own facilities. We do see some of the last miles that we would have on some of our lower transmission voltage facilities do not qualify for credits anymore. And so there are some adjustments in those that have occurred. The FERC settlement that I talked about really gets into, I think, one of the heart of the matters of how do we continue, because we're continually investing, as Rob Frank will talk about on facilities, looking at investing in areas where Basin and their members and WAPA's customers take service from us, that we're able to continue to allocate to them at least, you know, the share of those facilities that they're using. And I think that's the larger outcome of that FERC settlement, is saying that there is a better balance mechanism that is coming to help sure at least the long-term viability of those credits is protected and it's fair.
Okay, so that settlement will mitigate that, the transmission assets decreasing that they have to use?
It doesn't mitigate the ones that they're using, but it allows us to add others for either upgrades that we're doing for additional reliability projects or age or condition in the future.
Okay, so it kind of mitigates the lost revenue or their lost credits. Yeah. Okay, mm-hmm. Thank you.
I'm going to go back to where I started at the beginning. If you'd help me out a little bit here. I had listed off what the 2016 change was, what the 2017 change was, the 2018, and again, for people listening, 2016, no change in this rider. 2017, it went up by 99 cents. 2018, it went down by 69 cents. 2019, it went up by 25 cents. The four-year average prior to 2020 was just under 14 cents per month in terms of a change. And, you know, it gets to the question that was asked, and I asked it that at the beginning, essentially, what was so unique about 2020 and why was it, in fact, so far off? And you've talked about things that will mitigate that variance, or the current variance or a variance like this in the future. But was that unique just to 2019 and 2020? Because you were very close in how you estimated the preceding 4 years, you know, relatively close, under a dollar. It's not an exact science. It never will be, because there are too many uncontrollables that you have no say over, you know, whether it's from the federal level or one of the RTOs. But was that just a unique set of circumstances in 2019 that have now been corrected? You have to make up for it, or you're asking to make up for it in 2020, but or did those same variables exist in 2016, 17, and 18?
So that's a very good question. So the mechanism, as far as we use from 2015 and the variance from, you know, going forward, the amounts Commissioner Karashas, you talked about, you know, I think lead back to the way that we forecasted you know, these charges going forward, it worked very well. When we started taking this service and had this credit mechanism back in 2015, you know, we had an anomaly that happened in 2019 where the credit amounts we got from SPP were, you know, significantly less, I would say, from what we expected. And the transmission rate in Southwest Power Pool went up more than what the current rate was. And so in that case, in 2020, what we've been collecting did result in this, you know, under collection, you know, for the past period. So we talk about this true up because our amounts we had forecasted came in different than what they currently were in the current rates. It came into a shortfall we ended up having. And that shortfall, as Travis talked about, was the true-up amount. And that amount was the this $2 million number on the recovery balance because of the difference of the rates that came in as compared to forecasted for that 2019-2020 period. And so in that, we've taken a look at what's the best way to forecast that going forward, you know, what we did to try to make it better. And the other one we ended up doing is looking at why did we have such a shortfall in these revenue credits and to do what we could to make sure we get them back to where they were and that they're fair and balanced.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner Chrisman, I'm just going to check in. If you had any questions?
Yeah, I've been trying to get in, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, I apologize for that.
Getting back to this big difference in the expected revenue credits from the RTOs, especially SPP. I've heard several different things that account for that difference. Your assets have depreciated, so you get less return for the usage of them. Some kind of paperwork type changes and allocation things through either the RTOs or through FERC. And then there's physical things like people either just using less electricity and using your services less, or SPP members building transmission or SPP members building generation that uses other or new transmission. How do each of those kind of play into this as far as the makeup of this big change?
So the makeup of the big change, you know, the largest one is, you know, that calculation of how we come up with the revenue credits, you know, and we've seen a reduction from the 2015-2016 originally, you know, to where we're at of 8 million. We originally started out at a value that was probably closer to about 12 or 13 million. And it's steadily come down to this 8.3 number that we see. And a lot of that is one due to depreciation. And the other one that was mentioned in the filing, we've made investments in other parts of our system. And again, this may get a little technical, but the way that we allocate or come up with this credit amount is we determine our MISO revenue requirement, and then we do an allocation based on investments in gross plants to basically determine the gross plant that is eligible for credits out of all of the facilities, what's the percentage of revenue requirements we allocate. And we've seen some shortfalls in that because of where investments have been in the last couple of years, locations, that's reduced that percentage, at least of that allocation from that MISO transmission revenue requirement. You know, the FERC settlement will help offset, mitigate some of what we've seen or we identified. And then also with future investments, you know, that end up happening, at least in areas where we receive SPP credits, we'll make sure that we get a fair share of recovery of those in this credit line. And that really makes up the largest component we're talking about. The other one is at least the SPP transmission rate did change, you know, from 2019 to 2020, which was higher than we expected, which is what drove into the difference in the change in the total charges of $562,000 as compared to the prior period to the current filing.
If you answered this, I just missed it, but is there a significant amount of this that has to do with additional generation or transmission being built by SPP members that displaced the need to use MDU's transmission system?
Those have been a smaller component, at least of the impact, but there are some instances where that has reduced the credits we receive, the eligible line miles for some of our lower voltage facilities that we would see out in eastern Montana, western North Dakota. But that is a lesser piece, just as compared to the overall mechanism that's used to create the credit calculation.
Thank you.
So just the remainder of the slide, it's been talked about charges. MISO and SPP have been fairly predictable. That's for taking transmission service or costs allocated to us. And so the overall net change, at least to North Dakota customers, based on the credits and the charges we receive in this, is about $2.4 million is where we're at. The last comment I would make in this would be, when we started taking transmission service from Southwest Power Pool, you know, to supplement our MISO transmission service at the end of 2015, we did do an analysis, and we continue to do that to look at the benefits of taking transmission service from both RTOs. In that, we do continue to see greater value by taking transmission service from both MISO and Southwest Power Pool. And one of the biggest advantages we receive is how we have to meet our peak customer demand generation requirements. And so in participating in MISO and looking at the SPP tariff, there's a difference of how they calculate how much peak generation capacity you have to have. And so there's a lesser amount that we have to have in MISO because of how, as their tariff and approved by FERC, how they determine that as compared to Southwest Power Pool. And the impact of that is if we would completely withdraw from MISO, we would still have to continue to pay for the transmission facilities that were approved, that we're taking service for today, and we'd likely have to add about another 100 megawatts of generating capacity to meet that SPP peak generation requirement that we would have to meet.
Darcy, as long as you're on that, you had mentioned the MISO charges that would continue. I believe that would be approximately $6.5 million per year. If you were to exit MISO, because that, and this is a hypothetical, not that I'm advocating for it, but it was a question raised through input that we received from AARP, and essentially, just to cut to the chase, why don't you just exit MISO, but that would result in a $6.5 million charge in addition to new charges from SPP, and that plus a severance charge, if you will, to leave that RTO. How long would that $6.5 million be in play, and would that gradually decrease as items included depreciate out?
Good question. So when we look at the total charges line here on this slide, you know, we see there are MISO charges of $8.2 million that are in the current TCA filing. Of that, the number that's been mentioned is about $6.5 million of that is for transmission projects, you know, that we're paying at least that MISO has had built for services they provide. You know, because we were a member when those projects were approved, we have an obligation in the MISO tariff that if we would exit, we would continue to have to make payments for those $6.5 million of the $8.2 million. And those projects, we would see a reduction of that annually as those transmission projects, is what it relates to, would be depreciated over time. But that largely could take almost a 40-year period of time before those would go away to zero.
Okay, so it could be several hundred million, $100 million plus. It would be substantial, correct?
It would. Probably if you would do a net present value of all of that, it would be about $100 million.
If there aren't any more kind of granular questions from Randy on for Darcy, I have a broader one that I'd like to ask you, Darcy. And that is, you mentioned earlier that there's significant benefits to belonging to these power pools, and I think it would be fair to for somebody listening, one of the ratepayers listening, to not be seeing those benefits, obviously, right now when they look at some of the charges and the numbers that we're talking about. So if you could step through, I think you're probably the best one on the list of folks from MDU to speak to that. Could you talk about some of the benefits that MDU and your customers receives from being part of MISO or in a regional transmission organization like this? Why is it good for customers?
Yes, and prior to participation in regional transmission organizations, you know, we would have had our own system, which would have been an island interconnected with our neighbors, and we would have had to have basically went through other arrangements is how we operate, plan the system. And also we had to buy and sell electricity directly from others and to come up with our own resource dispatch, per se. So the island, the purposes of the regional transmission organizations are to combine those islands and to become as efficient as possible. And those are pieces that are driven either by recommendations by FERC or at least mandates that have come over time, one to improve reliability on the system, and the other one is open access and competition, at least in FERC's drivers. The large benefits we've seen from the regional transmission RTO participation is around how we are able to more efficiently buy energy for our customers through the market that's created through the RTO, which has reduced fuel and purchase power costs for our customers on their bill from what they otherwise would be if we had to self-dispatch our generation. And it's also reduced the amount of other requirements that FERC has created as far as how we would have to go off and separately do our planning and pay for that, and also, you know, the reliability services that we would have to basically put in place if we left the tariff services that were in the RTO. And the other significant benefit we've talked about, as I mentioned, the difference between MISO and Southwest Power Pool is the reduction in peaking or generation capacity requirements that we have if we have a standalone system or as compared to what our requirements were prior to joining the RTO. So we've seen a significant drop, at least in administrative charges to participate, a significant drop in fuel and purchase power to our customers, and then that drop that we've seen in our peaking capacity requirements have all been significant savings to our customers that they probably don't hear about or see on their bill every day.
So you, in a nutshell, believe, and maybe you have some dollar figures you could share or not, but you're getting, customers are getting a more reliable service at lower costs through the RTO involvement?
That is correct.
Do you have figures to show? Can you quantify that, Darcy?
So the one comment I would make is we did have looked previously, if we didn't participate in the regional transmission organization, and if we had to dispatch our own generation versus being able to buy from the market, I think the annual benefit to that is probably north of $10, if not $15 million a year of benefits on reductions in fuel and purchase power costs that we would see just because of the efficiency the market has. And the impact if we had to add another 100 megawatts of generation to meet our previous or Southwest Power Pool requirements to meet our peak demand requirements, I think the number we calculated the last time on that was a benefit of over $6 million as far as of reduced generation investment that we have to make. And if we turn around, it would quantify how much we would have for additional services, you know, that we would have to take. If we didn't have the tariff services that MISO provides for planning and operation and their studies, and we had to do those ourselves, there probably would be additional several millions of dollars we'd have to add on top of the cost we're spending with the RTO to provide those services and meet the requirements that we have to operate our system. So we're probably talking a savings of, at least in the, talking about MISO, these pieces, that probably is, you know, approaching somewhere near $20 million of savings benefits for the RTO participations.
Okay. And is that net the cost?
The net the cost for?
Would that be after you pay the cost, like after customers are paying the cost of this? I mean, assuming that they're paying, in this case, you know, whatever, however many millions a year to for the services provided.
So part of it, we would still have to take transmission service, at least from Southwest Power Pool, to use Wappan Basin's facilities. So we would still be incurring those costs, and we would also be incurring those $6.5 million of MISO costs I talked about. And that would be in addition to the benefits that I just described.
Okay.
So that, Darcy, that the $20 million is savings on an annual basis to customers kind of beyond this. So assuming the customers are already paying this amount, if you would not be a part of either of those RTOs, customers would be paying an additional $20 million per year on top of, right. of this.
Right. And that's based on some assumptions.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, I think the assumption is backed up, and we're still going to have, we have to evaluate the numbers you're presenting. But one fact that isn't talked about a lot, but I think it's an important fact, North Dakota is a low-cost leader in terms of energy to both households and businesses. And that's a fact. We rank in a very good way as one of the lowest-cost energy states, which is very good for consumers, but mechanisms like this, Darcy, being a member of MISO, being able to purchase power at a lower rate, that's how we get there, correct?
That is correct.
And I think it's just a fair point to make for people listening, because the number got my attention when you came in, and I know you're not done with the presentation, but the number certainly got my attention. And our job is to ask why, which we are. But I think it's also important that the public has the full picture in terms of how to create a balance that has benefits as well. But Commissioner Christman, did you have any questions, just checking in with you?
No, at this point, mine have been answered. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Okay. Please continue. It's been a good discussion so far.
That completes my comments on this slide. So, Travis, I think we're ready to move on.
Okay. Thank you, Darcy. And just one thing that I would like to point out, and, it doesn't get a lot of fanfare, but Darcy mentioned the lower fuel purchase power costs. You know, we do file every month with our fuel purchase power costs, and Commissioner Crotchus is correct, and those savings get passed back immediately. So we don't do those annually and then true them up. We pass those back each and every month. So with that, I'll just go to the next slide here, and Rob Frank, take it over.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. I will discuss the transmission cost adjustment related to transmission capital projects. To recap my position in the company, I'm the director of electric transmission engineering. Our department is responsible for design, construction, and maintenance of our transmission and substation facilities. And so we are tasked with building the transmission investments that are required to serve our customers' load and transmit power across our system. The six projects that we have proposed in this current TCA are listed on this slide, and I'll just talk through them briefly, one by one. The first one on the list is our Dickinson Transmission Loop line. This is a continuation of a project that we had started a couple of years ago, was in previous TCAs, where we are building a 115 kV loop around the city of Dickinson. to interconnect our existing facilities. This year's project is 6 miles of transmission line from the west side of Dickinson, or I'll say west to further west of Dickinson, to interconnect two of our existing substations. This provides benefits to the surrounding area and to the city of Dickinson in that it ties our system together through a loop, allowing additional redundancy to feeds for customers, as well as providing additional transmission line connections between Beulah area and our power plant and Hettinger, where our Thunder Spirit wind farm is. This project is part of our integrated system, is under construction right now, and will be complete in mid-November. Our Watford City Loop is the next one on this, is related to load serving capabilities that we have in the city of Watford City and the surrounding area. We serve Watford City from transmission that's provided from WAPA. And because of the nature of the feeds that were previously provided from WAPA to Watford City, it was a single source. And any time that we would have equipment failures or any sort of outages that would be required to maintain or any issues with that equipment would require outages or force outages to the residents of Watford City. And so by creating a loop line and building a second substation, we've increased the reliability, again, redundancy to those customers in that area by installing a loop and being able, again, to serve load from multiple locations or configure the system in different ways and still be able to serve load. That project is also under construction, complete here the end of November. This project is not part of our integrated system, and I know this was some of the questions, so I'll kind of talk through the process we use. When projects are related to specific load-serving customers and or not tied through at a larger voltage to the rest of our system, we typically are not integrated or part of the integrated system, and all of the costs of this project are allocated to the customers in North Dakota. And so that's that project. We can kind of maybe talk a little more about it as we go.
Robert, this is Victor with staff. I just want to follow up on what you just said a little bit. So we were just talking about Dickinson, and then we were talking about the Watford City, and they both appear to be loops that you're completing around each of those cities. And as you said, the Dickinson loop is being considered part of the integrated system. So North Dakota is a little over 70% of that system, so that's how much North Dakota is being asked to pay for. Conversely, the Watford City loop, you are saying, is entirely being assigned to North Dakota, so we would be paying 100% of that. I guess my question is, what's that differentiating point? I realize that the Dickinson loop is a 115 line versus the Watford City is a 60 kilovolt loop. Is that the deciding factor, or can you just talk a little bit more about that?
Unmuted.
Yes. So we look at a few different criteria to determine what's included in the integrated system and what's excluded. Voltage is one of the first qualifiers, I'll say, typically for what's included in an integrated system and what isn't. So the higher the voltage level, the more capability that transmission infrastructure has to transmit bulk power across our system. And so when we look at the Dickinson loop line, it's really a part of the transmission system that we have, like I said, that combines or connects our system at Beulah and our power plants through Dickinson to Hettinger and existing larger transmission infrastructure as well. So you get up to Beulah and you get up to our other 230, 345 kV system, as well as down at Hettinger, where there's an additional 230 kV system that we have. So that's tying that together, and it's a higher voltage. Watford City Loop, that 60 kV line, doesn't tie to anything else, and we really can't push any power through that loop line to get to a larger transmission system or transfer power across the system. And so it's really
a very much smaller loop and a lower voltage, and that's what's determining that. The things that also are going to play in the integrated system is where generation is located at. And so generation and our generating facilities, regardless of what voltage level they're at, will dictate or will determine, again, some of the lower voltage facilities that are included in the integrated system because of the addition of generation at those voltage levels.
Okay. So it's not simply a factor of the voltage level. It's a voltage and then how the part of the system could be used. And Watford Watford's probably a little bit more of an island from what you're describing there than Dickinson is, more of kind of a pass-through.
It is.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you for that.
Yes, so like I think I'd previously submitted some information where, yes, we are getting our transmission service when talking kind of through Darcy's presentation just previously here from Western Air Power Administration. And so they control all of the large transmission, and we're more or less a customer or user off of that system that they own. Speaking through the Mandan substation, this is an addition that we had done to an existing Mandan substation. What we're doing here relates to moving facilities from our existing Heskett switchyard and substation facilities that are next to our power plant and moving them to a new location just north of there. They're in the same vicinity, really less than a mile apart from one another. But it's a way for us to repair or replace aged and deteriorating equipment within the Heskett substation and be able to relocate those facilities up to Mandan. And so there was some substation investments that were required with that. The work that's currently being done this year was moving of a 230 kV line and then removing a 230 115 kV power transformer from Heskett to Mandan and those associated substation facilities that are required to allow that movement. That project is nearing completion, will be complete at the end of October this year. This again, because of its 230 115 kV nature and the facilities that we're installing in Mandan, this is also part of our larger bulk power transmission system, and so this is also an integrated system. The Crosby-Dazal transmission line rebuild is...
Robert, sorry to keep interrupting you here. I got another one on this one. So kind of talks about it's connected to the Wishick 230 kilovolt transmission line. Is that the same line that runs to the Emmons Logan wind farm that's currently being kind of reconducted?
I'm sorry, I'm losing you.
So what's that? So
I didn't hear what you said. I'm sorry. We're cutting out.
Sure. So this one is talking about it's connecting to the Wishick 230 kilovolt transmission line. Is that transmission line the same one that serves the Emmons Logan wind farm? I believe that line is currently under kind of reconstruction. It's being reconductored with some new poles.
That is correct. Yes.
So would this be considered a cause of that kind of upgrades happening to that line, or is this just kind of coincidental that we're messing with the connection point of that line right now?
It is coincidental in that the movement of the facilities at Mandan are really driven more from the retirement of the Heskett power plant and are being done to coincide with the transmission line rebuild work that's being done for Emmons Logan as part of a way to realize some efficiencies and cost savings related to some engineering and some construction work that's going through that. The cost of the transmission line move itself and any rebuild from Mandan to Wishick is being paid for by that wind farm development. Just the facilities at the Mandan substation are being paid for in this TCA.
Certainly.
Or included in the TCA.
Appreciate that. I just wanted to kind of flush that out, make sure this isn't actually tied to that and maybe should be looked to be paid for elsewhere. And just to confirm what you just said there, so there no portion of that line rebuild for the Emmons Logan will be paid for by MDU or MDU customers, correct? That's being entirely funded by the owner of that wind farm.
Okay, and also,
yes, that's correct.
Also for those listening, we're getting a little bit of feedback, so if you could mute your phone when you're not speaking, that would be good. Thank you. Do you hear it though?
Hear it. I think it might just be the room. I don't know.
Okay.
So it doesn't pick up. Is anyone doing it?
Okay. Okay. And what was the cost of the Mandan substation? Or
I think we've got an estimate. Let me review my.
Just Mandan.
Estimated $1.8 million.
Just for the Mandan substation? I'm not talking all six projects, just for the Mandan substation?
Just for the Mandan substation, that's correct.
Rob, if you're on that note, you can just give us the amount of each of the six.
Sure.
Yeah, and Commissioner Karashis, I would just mention that that's the capital investment and not the revenue requirement, just for clarification.
Oh, that's right. Okay, thank you, Travis.
Yes. I don't have a bill to me the revenue requirement of each individual project. I know that they're summarized in the project costs, but Travis would probably be able to provide if I can. But I can talk about overall capital costs of each project if you'd like to review that.
I don't know that I need that right now.
Commissioner Karashis. Okay. One thought. Travis, if you could explain for any listeners the difference between the capital costs and the revenue requirement, that would probably be helpful.
Sure, I can do that, Commissioner Perchik. So basically the capital cost is going to be what Rob has, dollars that he's going to spend in order to get that project up and running. So that'll be the cost of materials, the labor to install that, and the various other components of the cost. The revenue requirement is going to be essentially the recovery of the operating expenses, particularly depreciation, and it's going to be a return on that investment. So Robin mentioned the $1.8 million. So basically it's our return on that $1.8 million plus the depreciation and any other components. So the revenue requirement is always going to be a much smaller number than the capital investment. So I hope that answers that.
Yeah, just recognizing that ratepayers will pay for it over time with your return calculated into that figure, what they pay annually. Thank you.
Okay, and then talking through the last three, Crosby to Zoll transmission line rebuild was a reconstruction of a line that was deteriorating related to its condition in its location with respect to water within the transmission right-of-way and just repair of the line. This transmission line has been rebuilt earlier this year, was put into service in April 2020. And is also not integrated system due to its local load serving capabilities up in the Crosby and Zoll area of the our transmission system. It's also 60 kV voltage. Bismarck Sweet Avenue substation additions are work that's done to create and improve some reliability within the city of Bismarck and within our substation located within Bismarck. What we're doing is we're separating two load-serving power transformers from one transmission feed. I'll say we're adding facilities in the substation to split those transformers across two separate terminals, line terminals within that substation. And that substation is also near complete, will be complete at the end of October of 2020. And then the mobile substation is an investment we've made in mobile equipment. What it is it's circuit breakers, power transformer, and related substation equipment that's all mounted on trailers that can be towed by the regular semi-trucks or heavy-duty pickups or line trucks and pulled to any location and connected quickly and easily for any emergency use or any reliability use related to our maintaining and operating of our transmission system. So an example of where it's used today is we're working at our Lewis and Clark substation near the Lewis and Clark power plant. We were able to set up this mobile substation outside of the Lewis and Clark plant, tie the 115 kV system to our 60 kV system through this mobile substation, and remove the existing facilities that are at the Lewis and Clark substation. So we could serve the local load of the customers by removing permanent equipment, being able to replace or repair or reconfigure without causing any outages or any reliability or outages to customer load or sacrifices in service that may otherwise realize. The cost of this substation it was put into service this year, I'll say, or this just recently here, and is also included this. Any other questions on that one?
Were you going to indicate? Oh, go ahead, Commissioner Christman.
This is Randy. Am I right to guess that the Sweet Avenue substation is probably local and the mobile substation is probably part of the integrated system?
Yes, thank you. Yes, I would speak back to that. Yes, the Sweet Avenue substation is allocated only to North Dakota customers. It's related to, again, as we talked about before, primarily load serving customers locally and the benefits of those. Mobile substation can be used across our system. There's various voltage levels that it allows that substation to be connected to, allowing several different combinations of voltage levels. And so that can be used across the system and is considered our part of our integrated system.
Thank you.
You know, I think I'm going to change my mind just a little bit. I don't need it immediately, but and Victor, do we have this on hand already, the cost for the six different projects?
Yes, it's in the filing.
Right. So
I can
track that down through the filing, and
I can just cover here real quick. So Dickinson investment is $2 million. Watford $5.3 million. Mandan 1.8, Crosby 1.2, Bismarck Suite 1.1, and the mobile substation is 3.8. That's investment cost, not revenue requirement.
Right, okay. Total investment cost and then revenue requirement would be whatever the depreciation schedule is.
Depreciation, O&M.
Yep. Right.
Labor.
I do have a question related to this.
Yes. Don't like that part.
You know, since we're getting down to the summary, maybe now is the time to ask this question. I posed it as a hypothetical to staff earlier, and that is the total change is or the total ask is 6.9, is that correct? Well, not the total ask.
I think the total increase is about 6.3, if memory is serving here. I'm trying to get a lot of papers here, so.
I thought it was 6.9 or 335 a month, or was it 6.3?
6.3 million is the increase of this filing versus the last filing.
Okay, and then $3.35 a month.
Correct.
So a third of that is the six projects, just over a million, roughly. And then the under collected, well, it's more than a third.
The under-collected balance would be approximately a third at $2 million.
Right.
The new projects that we just finished talking about is $1 million between all of them. The existing projects that we had approved the last filing is an increase of $720,000. And then the increase to MISO SPP net expenses, really, I think we talked about that's more so a result of reduced credits. But that's an increase of $2.4 million.
Well, just to touch on a thought, and this is just a thought, and that is the timing, obviously, with the current pandemic, current situation is obviously less than ideal to see a jump in the cost of anything, frankly. In a perfect world, it wouldn't cost more to receive utilities, it wouldn't cost more to own vehicles, it wouldn't cost more to own a home. But I think we have to be cognizant that these are challenging times. So the question is, and it's just for the point of discussion, whether or not the under-recovered balance could be spread out over a two-year period versus 12-month period, and that's approximately $2 million. And then cost recovery on these projects, I know in a normal environment, we'd certainly have recovery begin immediately. But if there's, just for the point of conversation, the potential to delay that until the next transmission filing, cost adjustment filing. So just for a point of discussion.
I'll start, and probably Travis should weigh in here at some point, but spreading the under-recovered balance over a period greater than 1 year is something we have done in the past. I believe it was 2017, roughly, last rate case. We had a large under-collected balance across multiple riders, and we did agree between staff and the company to pass that back over 2 years rather than one. The pushing off the proposed new projects for the future rider, I guess that's something Travis could speak to. I mean, I guess it's something theoretically possible, but it's likely to increase costs to customers in the long term.
Right. I realize it just it kicks the can down the road in effect. It doesn't mean the cost goes away, but it just bridges what could potentially be a gap between current conditions and better times. And it's just food for thought.
Certainly.
One question on that, and I do have a question to go back a little bit too, but let's I'm good walking through this because this is an interesting point you're bringing forward, Commissioner Crossers. Could we get the numbers on what the total increase would be? Like, it's kicking the can down, and it's also increasing the size of the can because you're spreading it out longer and they're earning on that the entire time. So I'd be interested in what the overall higher bill would be for customers if we delay it so that we can weigh that in the consideration. I would assume that the company can or staff can make those calculations, not immediately, but for discussion purposes at the next time we discuss this.
Just kind of shooting from, just working through some of these numbers in my head. So the kicking the can down the road, the can picks up some earnings along the road. So I'm just trying to figure out what the total investment is. I'm guessing around $10 million roughly would be the rate base that would earn additional return over the course of a year. I want to say we're about 7% annually is the return level at present, considering all other factors. So that's what, $700,000? I don't know, maybe my math is failing me here, Travis. I don't know if you have a better kind of shooting from the hip kind of number.
And is that on just the new projects?
That would be just new, yeah.
Okay, so that would... And then we have to remember that the next time around, there's going to be a revenue requirement for those same projects, plus maybe some additional ones. So
yes,
you could be looking at a sizable increase the next time around.
Could be.
Which might be better timing. I agree, Commissioner Cautious. This is really tough timing. But
it is.
That would also then you'd have to add on the new projects plus the unrecovered stuff.
Correct.
If we've delayed both of those.
Correct.
The under-collected would be cleaner, if you will, spreading that, dispersing that over a two-year period.
Theoretically, I mean,
projects.
All of this, pushing anything off to a future period is a little bit taking a risk. We don't know what the future, you know, we had a $2 million under-collected balance in the last 12 months. If we have another one of those in the next 12 months for some other factors that come up, then we then have that compounded on top of it. And then instead of having to deal with $2 million next year, we would be dealing with that $2 million plus the remaining million of this.
Mm-hmm.
So there's risks associated with pushing things off to the future, although I recognize that you know, timing may not be appropriate too.
But again, I do go back to the previous 4 years, and the range of a reduction of 69 cents to an increase of 99 cents or an average of 14 cents per month in the preceding 4 years versus 335. And there's no guarantee that 2020 won't repeat itself in 2021. Although I think the company is taking steps to ensure that it won't. So I think that mitigates the risk substantially. But it's not without negatives, but I'm just thinking of, again, is there a way to better bridge the gap, potentially bridge the gap? Travis, do you have thoughts?
Thanks, Commissioner. So I generally agree with what Victor said. We have in the past did the unrecovered balance over a longer period of time. You know, Darcy did mention there's some potential upside in calculating our credits. So, you know, I think we'd certainly be open to either spreading that out over a longer period of time or just holding that over our under-collected balance and just keep it out of the rider. In terms of projects, certainly we can do that. If you remember early on in the presentation, you know, we had about $1 million that was associated with just the brand new projects. I think Victor, though, I think made a good point in that as those projects, you know, those are only in for a partial year. So you go into the next year and then you're going to have a pretty sizable boost. But I agree. I think we've really tried to shore up the credit side of it. And hopefully there's a bit of upside on that. And but we certainly would be open to, like I say, amortizing that out over a longer period of time, or, you know, potentially just leaving that under collected balance out. That would take care of about a third of it if we were to do that.
Okay, transmission upgrades, the capital projects, hadn't given that a lot of thought until just this morning, or it crossed my mind. I think that question's answered. Just I don't know that that would be a good idea, but I'm more interested in what was just discussed on what we might be able to do with the undercollected balance. So.
And one other thing that I would just point out, if you look in our filing back in May of 19, the interest rate that we were applying to those balances was 2.3%, almost 2.4%. The markets, obviously, given the pandemic, have changed substantially. And if I look at our June number, we were at 0.13%. So the reality is the interest component is not tremendously harmful to customers. And again, we use a three-month treasury rate, and all indications are that those treasury rates are not going to spring back up very quickly. So I think that mitigates some of the charges that Commissioner Fedorchak had mentioned, that the customers will ultimately be responsible, but it would be a minimal upcharge for that.
Right, right. I think that one is, well, I think I used the word cleaner, but Travis, you described it, I think, in a better fashion than quote-unquote cleaner. So,
a couple follow-up questions. So just to circle back and make sure I understand, what you guys are going to come to us with calculations on holding the unrecovered balance entirely until the next time, or spreading it over two time periods, correct? Both of those in terms of what the costs would be and the total costs. Okay. Two questions. One kind of goes back to the transmission projects, and another one is unrelated to that, but well, I'm going to ask them both at the same time, and somebody can be thinking about the second one. So the first one is, what's required for these new projects that you're adding in that are being allocated to either your system or just North Dakota customers? What would be required for those to qualify for broader cost recovery from MISO customers, so that they would be paying a portion of those? Because I know we pay a portion of some projects in other states, and I've never been super clear about when we have to pay for some of the projects in other states. And so if you could clarify that. And then the second question is, what is available for the company in terms of federal coronavirus funding sources, low interest loans, grants, etc.? What might be available, or what have you explored that could potentially offset some of this increase, if any such thing exists? So those are my two questions. I don't care which order you answer them, and thank you.
Darcy, could you take the first one?
I can. This is Darcy Nagum, and I had to find my mute buttons. Regarding cost allocations for some of these new projects to MISO, you know, Commissioner Fedorchak, it is not available for these. You know, these are either more of a local baseline reliability project or more of an agent condition or system improvement. The cost allocation for those has changed in MISO. That would be several years ago for baseline reliability. So there's no criteria to recover these under the MISO tariff, and also because of the voltage levels that they're at. I would say, at least for the Dickinson Transmission Loop Line, this is one that was a part of that FERC settlement that I talked about we have filed last week on SPP facility credits. That one is eligible to receive additional SPP credits.
So you'll earn money on that over time? From SPP customers, mm-hmm. They'll pay a fee to use it?
Yes, we'll be able to add that investment into that gross plant allocator calculation, and we'll be able to receive a higher amount of SPP credits going forward.
Thank you, Darcy.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Commissioner Christman, go ahead.
I want to just weigh in a little bit on spreading some of these costs out longer. And I don't mean to say I'm completely against it regardless. I'll contemplate it. Probably find it more acceptable on the under-recovered portion than on the construction projects. But just because something was done in the past doesn't mean that we want to make a habit of it. And let me just say, when it comes to construction projects, it seems like every time one is announced or there's groundbreaking, there's a big celebration and it's this wonderful economic development like it's manna from heaven that nobody ever has to pay for. And anytime that we then start getting the bills for it, and this isn't just 1 year, it will either stay in the rider or after the next rate case, some of these costs will get shifted into the rate base. And it's going to be around a while. And anything that we're paying for now that was maybe put off by a previous commission years ago is adding to the burden that people are paying now in this tough time. So I think it's only in the most extreme circumstances when we want to shuffle things off till later, because it really flies in the face of, you know, some of the base philosophies of rate making that the people who get the benefit should pay for it. And when we kick that can down the road, that means that some people who are going to benefit in the first year won't pay that amount and will no longer be customers in the last year, but some new people who have nothing to do with this decision will be paying one extra year.
Commissioner Fedorchak, did you have another question? I have one.
No, just they didn't answer the question yet about the federal funding and what avenues you've pursued there in terms of relief to your potential customers through low interest loans, et cetera, from the federal relief packages.
Commissioner Fedorchak, Travis Jacobson again. We have pursued, or I should say we've investigated a number of the programs. A lot of it is due to our size. We're not able to qualify for anything specifically. I will point out that, you know, the state of North Dakota, on an individual customer basis, did for electric utilities, or for electric customers, I should say, to have part of their utilities covered through that. And, you know, we have worked with customers in terms of payment plans and those kind of things. And directing them to any federal dollars that they're individually eligible for. But in terms of the company specifically, I'm not aware of anything that we've been able to obtain there.
Thank you, Travis.
Okay, say Travis, and you may have said this and I was just pulling it up, but did you mention LIHEAP? Low-income Home Energy Assistance Program. It's a federal program for individuals that are having trouble paying their energy bills. Is that something you're promoting? Or obviously, I think we should review that here at the commission and see if that's something that we can also help get the word out for. But what level of participation have you seen in that program with your customers? Do you know offhand?
You know, right offhand, I don't have a good number for you. We do promote any kind of assistance programs, whether it's a community action in some of our states or the LIHEAP. Again, the one I just mentioned, I believe, was through the CARES Act, mm-hmm. and the Department of Human Services at the state of North Dakota had indicated, I believe the number is $450 for electric customers. And so any of these programs that are available, we have directed customers to that. Our customer service center does do a lot of work, and you know, we do pursue those, and we promote them. A lot of that, you know, we do electronically or in bill stuffer form, but then also our customer experience team, when they're taking calls, they direct customers. They inform them of the programs that are available, and they try to get them to participate. It's one of those where we can't make people participate, and there are some hurdles they have to jump individually to get into those programs, but we certainly pursue and promote all of those type of programs to help our customers.
Okay. All right. And we can work on that from our end of things as well. But for the purpose of today, the transmission, and I apologize, I think I steered us off a little bit, but an important topic nonetheless. But if you want to wrap up and then we can give direction on the public input portion, and I'll check with the other commissioners. Commissioner Christman, did you have a question before or after they give their summary?
Yes, I do. Just one thing that I'd also like to address. I believe that the numbers that we're working with hinged on this being effective November 1st, which I have a hard time imagining that this is going to get done that quickly. And so if it becomes December 1st or even January 1st, how much of a difference would that make in that average monthly residential bill that we kind of use as a metric? That's all I wanted to add.
Okay, if this is a good time, I'll do my wrap-up summary, and then I can tag that on for Commissioner Crispin at the end. Again, just in summary, based on our filing, we're requesting a recovery of the total cost of $15.5 million. And as we've discussed at length, that includes $1.6 million of an under-recovered balance. These costs, you know, they include, we talked about the three buckets, the regional transmission operator charges from SPP and MISO, transmission projects, which we delved into a little bit, and then again, the under-recovered balance. As Commissioner Crispin had pointed out, we did request a November 1, 2020 effective date. If we were to push that back a month, we estimate that it would increase our under-collected balance by a little over $225,000. If we were to push it back an additional month, i.e. January 1 effective date, that would add about $300,000. As well. Now, you know, we talked a little bit about the settlement agreement, and if there is some upside there, some stability, you know, we could potentially have some offset there. So it would, we wouldn't necessarily have to adjust the rates. If we were to push it back, we could maintain that same rate, and essentially it would have the effect that Commissioner Crosha had talked about, is maybe pushing some of that deferred balance back. So that's certainly, we could also run numbers if those, we'd rather do something different.
All right, Victor, did you have something you wanted to add?
It looks yeah, like. So I have a few things I just want to kind of cover. So I think what we've heard from commissioners, they'd like the company to provide two different views of the rates, or actually I think maybe even a few more than that now. So what the rates would look like with pushing the under-recovered balance over a period of 2 years, or pushing the under-recovered balance off until the entire thing off until next year. And then I think just because of the real timing aspect that we're looking at here, what do the different scenarios look like if we do not implement this until December 1 and or January 1?
I believe that's correct, yes.
Okay. And I would agree with what Travis is saying for the amounts that this would go up the longer we wait. You know, I think that the 235,000 number for November, I think just kind of a rough guesstimate, that would probably increase the residential monthly cost another probably 30 cents per month, adding that much onto it. So it's real significant numbers the longer we wait.
Mm-hmm.
couple other things. So the under-recovered balance, something I was looking at in this filing specifically that we haven't in the past. So we come up with the total revenue requirement, and we use a transmission allocation factor that was agreed to in the last rate case to determine what customer classes pay what percentage of that revenue requirement. Then we set the rate, they collect their actuals, and then we get this true-up balance. Now, in the past, we've always just kind of peanut butter spread that true-up balance back into the entire revenue requirement, not really taking into account that one customer class may be under-recovering and one may be over-recovering. And when you spread that back out over the entire balance, you could be changing the allocation between the customer classes, whereby, so let's say the commercial class is over-collecting and the residential class is under-collecting, then you would essentially be shifting more of those costs over time to the commercial class. But it certainly could happen the opposite way as well. In this particular filing, if we were to want to correct that longer term, it would result in even larger costs to residential customers because they actually, I honestly don't remember the I have too many numbers in my head at this moment to say which direction they went. But I think for future filings, it's something we should look to do to keep those true-up balances in the customer classes that caused them so that we're not changing the allocation between the classes.
So how do you allocate them?
You don't
use the same formula?
Well, no. So we just wipe that whole total. So it might be one's up, one's down.
Yeah.
We just take that total, add it to the total revenue requirement, and then re-split it. Mm. So if everyone is contributing to it equally, that's fine. But if one class is up and one is down, it's changing that spread by a small amount, but it's changing it every year.
Okay.
So again, I'm not saying we should do that this go around, but I think we should look to do that starting next year to keep those true ups with the customer class that created them.
Yeah, I would agree, and not that you specifically stated that now is not the time, but I will say now is not the time, in my opinion.
Right. And yeah, I think that's actually all I had. Oh, sorry. One other quick one before we get to the customer stuff. So this is related to customer comments, so I just wanted to kind of note for the record, as of this morning, we received 96 customer comments on this case. They were largely kind of canned responses via AARP. I think everyone has seen what the language is on each of them, but I just wanted to note for the record, we have 96 of those.
Right. And I do appreciate, the commission appreciates, I think it's fair to say, the comments that we have received from the public. Your concerns are certainly heard, and we will balance what companies are entitled to as regulated utilities in statute with what we can do from a legal standpoint on our end in terms of recovery. So, and I think some of those thoughts have been expressed as we've gone through this. Before we do go to the public input portion, I'm going to make one final round. But just so everyone knows, we will be taking probably a 10-minute recess just so people can regroup before continuing on. But Commissioner Fedorchak?
Question for Victor and Brian, too. So you've looked at this filing and the significant under-recovery balance. What's your take on that, and are you comfortable with what the company has said in kind of their defense and their plans for mitigating that in the future?
I'm reasonably comfortable with it. I think true-up balances are something we've seen more from MDU than from some of the other utilities we regulate. I can't say that it's one consistent cause every year, but it is something that we've seen quite often. So I'm comfortable with the steps they're taking to help prevent this in the future, but I'm cautiously optimistic, I guess I would say. We don't know how the continuing coronavirus pandemic is going to impact usage, and particularly on these type of riders that are entirely driven on usage. You know, there is, you know, unlike a base rate, there is no component of this that everyone pays. I mean, if you really want to control how much of this you pay, use less energy. And you can directly control how much of it you are paying as an individual or a company. So that's the real big unknown, I think, for this one next year that I'm concerned about, I guess.
Mm-hmm. You don't see any systematic problems that are causing the company to miscalculate stuff?
Nothing systematic. It's, you know, I have looked at the variances that we've had over the years, and they're all unique circumstances. I do find it odd, like I said, that we see larger true-ups with MDU than we do with the other utilities, but I haven't found any systematic issues that would lead me to ask or require them to do anything differently with their calculations or forecasting.
And are there any tools? This is just, I just came to mind, so I'll throw it out there. Are there any tools at our disposal that we'd be allowed to fairly use to cap true-ups or something of that nature?
I don't believe so. We're kind of limited by the tariff language we had approved originally. I mean, we can always modify it, obviously, but the true-up is something that is required for them to recover per the tariff language.
And the problem being what Randy kind of outlined in his concerns about putting off, that whenever you're truing something up, you're charging it from customers who may not have been there when the costs were incurred or have since left, and so they didn't have to pay for the costs that they benefited, the services they benefited from that time. So we want the estimates to be as close as possible.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Victor.
Thank you.
Okay. Darcy, Travis, do you have anything further that you would like to add before we take a recess?
I guess the only thing I would add, kind of to Victor's point of tracking the over under balance by group of customers, we do that in our FCAs and PGAs, so it's not a concept that is foreign to us, and we certainly would be open to that. Victor kind of pointed out that in the past, the balances have been significant, and even if we were to reallocate this balance, it wouldn't make a significant change, but it certainly, I think Victor has a very good point that on a go-forward basis, that would be a wise thing to do, and we certainly could implement that. And with that, I have nothing else to say, and I don't know if Carl, Darcy, or Rob have anything, so.
All right. Well, Commissioner Christman, anything further before we go into recess?
Nothing more at this time. I'm ready and anxious to hear from the public.
Okay. Commissioner Fedorchak? Staff? Okay. We will take a recess, I'm thinking, until how much time would everyone like? Are we good to come back at 25 to, or should we make it 22? Okay, so at 11:35, we will reconvene the informal. So we'll give everyone a chance to stretch their legs and whatever else. Okay, thanks, everyone. Yes.
Okay.
And then can we see if we have company representatives still on, or I'm assuming we do?
Still in the GoToMeeting, whether or not they're okay. Sitting at their computer.
Okay. And we are live and recording, correct, Matt? Okay. Well, welcome back, everyone. As mentioned, this is the public input portion of the informal hearing. And I'm going to turn it over to Matt. He is here on staff, and he will be walking people through the process to take public input, so we will do that, and then at the conclusion of the public input portion, we'll make a determination on whether or not to go back to the company representatives on any response, clarification, et cetera, that may be beneficial. So, okay. Okay, Matt, I'm going to turn it over to you, and we'll begin.
Okay. First on the list for public input is Jeanette Cutler, and I see they are in the open voice bridge, so I will just go ahead and unmute them and let them speak there. Hello, Jeanette.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, and I'm on a different line, but it doesn't matter. So, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm honored to be first up. This has been very interesting, and so I am thankful to AARP for making this happen. Like I said, it's been very educational for me. I tried to keep track of who everybody was, but Victor was a person that I was. Is he a commissioner or?
Victor is a staff member. He's one of our analysts in the Public Utility Division.
Okay. Thank you. So one of the perceptions I got from the commission is that eventually, one way or another, the ratepayers would be responsible for these increases. Does that make sense? We talked about kicking it down the future. We talked about a big part of the request for right now is the anomalies from the miscalculations historically. We've talked about how they've been defrayed over different time periods. But like I said, and then when we heard about Rob's expenses with the transmission line, there was always, I got the impression from the commissioners that eventually this would be put forth to the commission and would be approved, and ratepayers would be responsible for these expenses.
Well, I think there are two elements to consider. One, is the company entitled legally to recover expenditures? And the law is very clear in the fact that they are. That's something that has been set forth by the legislature, not only through the rider mechanism, but just through the utility rate regulation. But the second component is we make the determination as to whether or not those expenses qualify. And again, we apply the law. Are they recoverable? So we haven't made that final determination yet on whether or not this is or isn't recoverable. That doesn't occur officially until a vote is taken. But from my standpoint and from what staff has provided in terms of input and review, it's more a matter of timing, I believe, than it is on whether or not these expenses are actually recoverable.
Staff refers to the commission staff?
Correct.
Versus the company?
Right. We rely on commission staff. I certainly do. I would say it's fair to say that all the commissioners do that. We're looking at it from our perspective. We're looking at it from how does the law read, and do these expenses qualify?
Okay. One thing about Montana Dakota Utilities, it's a for-profit company, and it's pretty well known that the electric side is what generates the profits, the profitability within the organization themselves. And so coming from historically from the public sector, when there needed to be cost measures, cost things taken, you looked at maybe salary reductions, you looked at modifications that where the profit margin wasn't there, you cut back. And so with a public for-profit type of benefit, where there's anomalies and miscalculations, and somebody did hit it off the nail on the head, why are current customers then, why are the ratepayers expected to pick up the expenses for the profitability of a company. And when they asked about like the federal money being used, that was a very good question. And when they asked about different type of programs that MDU might provide to their customers with energy use, I don't know that they're very solid. I've got properties and been a resident in other under other utility holders where they do energy audits, and they're a lot more helpful. So I just don't exactly understand why the management of the company, or mismanagement or miscalculation, gets passed off automatically to the ratepayers. And I did follow Victor's recommendations if I didn't like the expenses or the cost to use less energy. So, but I don't know. Like I said, the perception I got from the commission was that eventually, one way or another, that the ratepayers would be responsible for the profitability of the company with their electricity generation and transmission.
You know, I would say generally, again, if the expenses qualify based on how the law is written, and remember, we're a regulatory body. Our job is to apply the law. So we have to take that measurement first. But the other point, MDU is capped in terms of their rate of return. It's at 9.65% on the electric side, I believe. Is that correct, Victor?
Yeah, it's not a cap. That's what we set their authorized
rate of return.
Correct.
And we watch that very closely to make sure that they don't exceed and keep it as close as we can. And typically it's fairly close. And when it starts to decline, at some point in time, the company will, in all likelihood, come in for a rate case and have to review it at that point in time.
I'll just add to that. This is Victor with staff. So we're not guaranteeing the company any returns. We, per the law, we have to allow them an opportunity to earn a return. And we do that by setting rates on their rate base. And the rate base is really the expenses that they incurred, you know, to invest in transmission lines and power plants and things like that. Really, our opportunities to impact that is to tell them what types of those items we like them to invest in and which ones we don't. And beyond that, once we have said that this is this was money spent reasonably and prudently for the benefit of the public, then it's not a guarantee. It's an opportunity to earn that return. So if the company manages themselves well, they will earn that return, but if they don't, they may not.
Thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Yeah, Janet, I think Commissioner Fedorchuk has something.
Just one other question for Victor along the lines. Do you recall in their last annual report what the rate of return for the utility was?
I don't.
Have they met it?
There's lots of numbers jumbling around in my head. I'm pretty sure they had under collected from the 9.65 that they were granted.
So they
generally in the last couple of years have under earned from that authorized level of 9.65.
And as a PSC staffer, when you evaluate and when the company looks at their under earnings, they can do a number of, they can decide to address it in any number of ways. The way that affects us is they might decide that they don't have enough revenues, which means they need to charge higher rates, and then they would come to us for a rate increase. But they could also reduce their costs as well.
They absolutely could.
And when they come to us for a rate case, we look at what their costs are and if they're reasonable.
We do.
And say, like, you know, no, we don't agree with that salary package or that approach to payments or retirement or, you know, all those various whatever the costs might be.
Yep.
Those are the things we look at in a rate case.
Yep. And generally in a rate case, there are there are those type of costs that we have, you know, in this rider proceeding, we're very limited. You know, we're talking about very specific resources that are set out in law that they can request recovery of. There's not a lot of leeway within this, whereas in a rate case, everything is up for grabs. So we generally will have at least a few different types of expenses that we will say, no, you know, we're not okay with customers paying for advertising for this, that, or the other thing, or some other type of expense, economic development, for an example. We will generally have a lot of those kind of things during a rate case where we'll say, no, ratepayers will not pay for that cost. The company can still do those things, but ratepayers will not be on the hook for it.
And by that, we mean you cannot make that into your rates.
Exactly.
Which is this whole idea of rate base. That's what we base the rates on. So you can't count those advertising costs or those contributions to economic development programs. You can't count that in your rate base on which you can charge customers.
Correct.
Just all these terms that are not things that people use every day try to get your brain around when you're digging into these issues as a customer.
Correct.
Well, Janet brings up some very good points. I don't know if she's still on the line or you bring up some very good points, Janet, and I think they're the logical questions and ones that I'm quite certain many ratepayers have in terms of, you know, how do charges originate? What is recoverable? What isn't? You know, that ties back to statute. Victor just brought up the fact that a rate case is a different proceeding in the sense that there's more flexibility, I think, on the commission's part. And the case being the last rate case was a request of $13.4 million from MDU. And they were awarded $7.5 million at the conclusion of that rate case. So they certainly did not get everything that they were asking for. And it's you know, we work hard, frankly, at keeping a healthy balance between making sure they can provide reliable service, but at the same time trying to keep costs down for consumers. So it's a balancing act.
Just another quick point I think we should talk a little bit about, and that is this notion of the for-profit company and this rate of return. I think that's something that bothers customers quite a lot, and I can understand and appreciate that this allowable rate of return, it's not a guaranteed rate of return, which you already emphasized, Victor. But why should an investor-owned utility be able to make a rate of return or add an earning component to their costs? Why should they be able to do that?
It's in the law that we essentially have to do this, or I guess more so in case law that we have to allow them that opportunity.
Why is it in the law? Why is it justifiable?
In order to encourage them to do this, if the company, you know, any company, be it a regulated utility or publicly traded, private, whatever, they're in the business to make money. And if we don't provide them an opportunity to make money, then they'll go do something else. So,
and they being who? They're investors?
They're investors, yes.
Right. That's who the they is.
Correct. So we have to set that rate of return at a level that's high enough to attract investors such that they can make the investments necessary to ensure reliable, safe and reliable service.
And how's that different in a cooperative?
Yeah,
go ahead.
No, I'm appreciative that you're asking for this clarification and defining who the they is. I also had a question on whose case law it's based on.
Well, that's the legal guys to answer
one
that one.
One of the legal beagles to talk about that.
It would be any applicable federal and state of North Dakota case law. Mostly it's going to be with state law of the state of North Dakota with these issues that are in our code and rules.
I happen to be taking right now another course in regulatory policy. And so a lot of these are questions that are gone over in those kind of courses, like the fundamentals. And I thought it's always good to revisit that stuff. This dates back to the 1800s when the regulation of utilities and the whole concept of public utilities first started in the U.S., and there's a lot of even Supreme Court case law over these issues, because quite honestly, at any point, if the company feels like we're not being fair in allowing them to recover the expenses that they have in order to provide the services to our customers, they can sue, come back and say this isn't appropriate, and they can overturn our decision in court, and then the court has to look and decide, is that a reasonable cost that the company incurred to serve its customers? If it is, they should be allowed to recover it with a earning. And then those cases go all the way up. And there's a lot of history in state and federal case law to address these issues.
I think getting to the heart, though, of why these publicly traded utilities, because we don't regulate co-ops, but we do regulate publicly traded utilities. And really, I think one of the most important points is the fact that they have monopolies on respective markets. They own the transmission. They have the distribution. They have their own generation. It's very difficult then for someone else to come in and compete on the same distribution system. A company's just not going to allow that. So if they weren't regulated with a reasonable rate of return so they can attract capital to do business at a low rate because they need to be a decent investment for the banking community, whomever, the investment community to look at, I think what would definitely, without question, happen, I think rates would skyrocket if they weren't regulated because they control markets. So that is one of the prime reasons why the regulatory the regulation was put in place to begin with, to protect consumers from monopolies on the utility side.
And your explanation shed a lot more light on things for me as well. I haven't been in Bismarck too awfully long, about 3.5 years. In the first 18 months, I was in an all-electric in a co-op service area. And the price of the energy was much cheaper than I am now that I am in the MDU service area. So.
One other thing, Janet, regarding co-ops, and there's also municipal power providers in some communities have their own. I don't know that we have any in North Dakota. Valley City, maybe?
There are a couple. Grafton is as well.
Grafton, okay. So there's a few that are owned by the city, and those are regulated differently. The co-ops, they aren't regulated by the Public Service Commission. They aren't an investor-owned. They're cooperatively owned. So the theory is they're regulated by their members who own the company, in theory. So you elect a board of directors to represent you, and they are the quote-unquote regulators of the company. And so they aren't subject to our oversight, nor are the municipal power providers, because they are owned by the city, who has elected leaders overseeing it. So the whole theory being, if you don't like what's happening, and then you can choose different leaders. They're the ones overseeing it and providing the quote-unquote regulations. So that's kind of the philosophy behind the various regulatory schemes and regimes that exist out there. And so that's why the Public Service Commission doesn't have authority over those other, like, cooperatives or municipally owned entities. As to why you pay more now than your other cooperative, we do look pretty closely at the rates that our investor-owned are paying as it relates to, or as it compares to the cooperative, and generally in North Dakota, I believe the investor-owned utilities are lower than the cooperatives, but maybe Jack or on par with them. It pretty closely aligned. There's not a huge discrepancy.
I think it varies a little bit. I would agree with that overall. The one thing that they're tough to compare in some sense is because, you know, a rural cooperative is covering more ground and versus a utility serving a large metro area where the distribution system is more condensed. So I think it depends. If you get into southwestern North Dakota, it probably costs more to distribute than a cooperative that is serving South Grand Forks, for example. But, Janet, you bring up some really, really good points and questions. Did you have anything else you wanted to ask us?
No, it's been so educational for me to participate and to listen in, and then your clarification, I just really have appreciated that. As a current ratepayer, though, don't think this is really good timing to pick up the burden of the expense for the historic anomalies and not being real crystal clear on what the future is going to bring. So I guess that's my two cents.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Janet. Really do appreciate your thoughts and your input. Very valuable. So, Matt, why don't we move to the next?
Sure. Okay. Next on the list is George Simek. I'll go ahead and dial them. Hello, is this George Simek?
Yes.
And you wanted to provide some input on today's informal with MDU?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, it's all yours, George. This is Commissioner Crassus. You can go whenever you're ready.
Okay. This was a very informational meeting. I learned a lot, and some of my questions were answered at. And one of the things was where the increase with rate would be used, and I can see it's going to be used in the projects that are ongoing right now in the western part of North Dakota. And another thing was I was wondering, is it just going to be residential or commercial included, or are municipalities also going to be included in that rate increase? And I was looking at their little sheet that they sent out with their monthly statement, and I see that the large and general contractors are going to have an increase as well as lighting. And that was one another question was being a resident of Bismarck, on our utility bills, we get a fee that pays for maintenance and lighting. And I was just looking at that, and I thought, well, am I going to get hit twice on this increase on my home as well as on my bill on the street lighting? So I kind of questioned that, and I hope that it is. If the city gets built, they're going to just have it a pass-through thing to us residents here, so... and then the other question was, if this would be, would that be just a line item on our bill, so we could kind of watch it and see in 12 months if it's going to disappear or what it's going to be. So,
okay. We'll have Victor follow up with you, but stay on the line, George. You might have some follow up questions after Victor explains.
Yeah. So, George, this is Victor with staff. So yes, all customer classes would be getting this increase. You know, so this is a line item on every electric bill with Montana Dakota Utilities. It's the transmission cost adjustment. I believe it says TCA, if memory serves, on your bill. So any customer class, which is all of them at this point, who receive that line item on the bill would see an increase. The amount of that increase will be different for the different classes, but it would be a similar percentage likely, the amount of the increase. Your question on the lighting, yes, you know, certainly if as a resident of Bismarck, I do believe Bismarck takes advantage of the lighting service that MDU does provide. So you would likely see that kind of wouldn't say it's a double charge necessarily, but you would be seeing two different sides of that as well. And your final question, I'm trying to recall what that was.
Projects. The projects in Western North Dakota.
The projects in Western North Dakota.
Yeah, I could see where they want their increase and where the money is going to go. It's mm-hmm. going to go to pay for the projects that are ongoing right now. So,
correct.
I was wondering if it was going to go out of state. You know, our increase was going to go to cover projects in other parts of the country or something like that. You know.
Some of it, yes. So MDU covers, you know, a multitude of more than just North Dakota. You know, we're certainly the biggest chunk of their territory, but that they do serve customers in Montana and South Dakota and even into Wyoming as well. So from time to time, they do have projects in those other states that we would pay a portion of. But similarly, you know, some of these projects we were talking about, you know, so the Dickinson one, you know, that project is located in North Dakota, but North Dakota customers are only paying approximately 70% of that project, where the other 30% is going to be paid by the customers of MDU in Montana, Wyoming, and South Dakota. So similarly, when there's projects in those states, we would pay a portion of those as well, provided it meets those kind of requirements we talked about. You know, if it's the voltage level is large enough and it's providing a benefit to more than just the local distribution system.
Victor, if I may too, maybe it'd be worthwhile to explain that we do break these down by jurisdictional shares though, and the staff does evaluate those costs per state and allocate that accordingly as well.
Yep, we absolutely do that. Thanks for the clarification. And then yes.
And Mr. Chairman?
Commissioner Christman, go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, this is Randy, and just to add on to that, if George, if you recall or got to hear that part of it, when we went through those six projects, they mentioned some of them as being more local, which they meant North Dakota, and where North Dakota consumers pay the complete cost of it. But I think three of them they referred to as being part of their overall system, their integrated system plan, and their North Dakota customers pay just 70% of it approximately because it's part of that integrated system that Victor was just talking about with the other states. Those other states' consumers pay for parts of it too. And then the other thing I wanted to just add, because it was partially addressed, as George mentioned, the municipal costs will get passed on to the residents there in the form of their taxes, I presume. And same with the commercial costs, because we'll all pay for those and the goods and services that those commercial users provide to stay in business. So yeah, it does trickle down. All these costs do.
Yeah, and George, so this is Victor again. So the we had talked a little bit about the MISO and SPP charges as well. So some of those charges would be for projects located outside of North Dakota as well. And those would be for MDU's usage of others' facilities in order to get power to MDU's customers. So some of that is likely located outside of North Dakota as well.
Yeah, I understand that. You know, there's no free will offering here. You got to pay for your service. You know,
sure.
And I could, that's why I said it was very informational. But MISO, I didn't really understand what that was, but it sure they really did explain how they belong to that power pool and how they have get credits by it, how much they use. I can see that. They use more, they maybe get more credit. So it's just like a dividend paying, buying from that company, or, you know, from different power pools. So yeah, it was very good. I enjoy it. I can see we have to pay for our services, and I don't feel that we need to deny it, but maybe it's not the right timing right now. So, but when is a good time, though? That's the other question that you know. So, that's all I've got. So, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, George. And before we go to the next individual that will provide input, just for everyone listening, one of the things that we work very hard at is making sure that costs are allocated fairly so that North Dakota customers are not picking up more than they should have to pick up. And there's some give and take, but you know, at the end of the day, it's about, is it fair for North Dakota ratepayers? And that element of fairness is really at the top of the list each and every time on any rate case like this. So, Matt, we have...
last one up is Josh Eskvig.
Okay, and then just for anyone else listening, we will give the opportunity to, and you may have mentioned this, Matt, to do a virtual hand raise if someone else is called in. So, Josh, you're up next, and then we'll double check to make sure we've got everyone taken care of.
Josh.
Hello, Josh.
Hello.
This is Public Service Commission. You wanted to provide input.
There we go. Yep. Sorry, my Bluetooth wasn't connecting. Got it now. So.
All right.
Okay, Josh, it's all yours.
Commissioner Crossis, or Chairman Crossis, Commissioner Storchek, Chrisman, staff, and MDU. I wanted to start by, first of all, thank you for holding the public comment hearing on this transmission cost adjustment rider filing. I think the newspaper and other outlets have reported that it was a break in what you've normally done, and you mentioned that at the top, Mr. Chairman, and I think it's an important one. You know, we've had an unprecedented year in many, many aspects, and so I appreciate you guys taking the time to do it as part of it. Just for those who don't know, I think probably all of you do, but if you're folks listening online, Josh Eskvig, I'm the state director for AARP North Dakota, and we advocate for North Dakotans 50-plus, as well as all residential utility customers in North Dakota and around the country. And many of our members take electric service from Montana Dakota Utility, and many MDU customers, including AARP members, are on lower fixed incomes. Others have lost their job or are suffering economically due to COVID-19, and an increase like this one here is too steep. And I think the extra diligence and explanation by MDU today was helpful, but I would say that the increase is still troubling because much of it is, as was just stated, and I think the question was spot on by the previous caller, George, about going to fund transmission upgrades in other states that are of limited or no benefit to North Dakota under the multi-value MISO transmission project plan. Additionally, the increased request also includes funding proposed for MDU projects not in service, and AARP has said and believes that projects not yet in service should not be recovered in a rider at this time, that perhaps the rate base would be more appropriate for that type of cost recovery. And then last but certainly not least, the size of the increase is alarming. You know, I think Commissioner Crossis, you outlining what's happened over the past period of time related to this rider was helpful and important to understand why, when we help consumers understand what was happening, you've gotten such a significant number of emails and people commenting. And if you followed online related to the news stories or on Facebook or even on our Facebook page, there's certainly been a lot of comments about why is this going up another $40 a year, and our members cannot afford another $40 per year. And part of that ties all the way back to the rate of return or the ROE that was authorized in MDU's last rate case. And I understand how it works. I think Commissioner Fedorchuk and Victor did a pretty good job of explaining the rate of return and that it's an authorized rate of return. And I think that, but it is too high given certainly the reduction in interest rates, especially during the pandemic as part of it. The one other item I just wanted to note is that, you know, I think the questioning related to MISO was really important today, and I appreciate, commissioners, the questions you asked, because our belief is MDU is in the wrong regional transmission operator, and that's raising costs to customers. And we say that because, MDU takes its service from WAPA to serve much of its load, and WAPA is in the Southwest Power Pool, and MDU is in MISO, and so there's additional costs that would be eliminated if MDU simply joined SPP. And so we don't think there's a reason for MDU to stay in MISO. I think the last time we intervened in a rate case, we said that as well. And so we still believe that. And we think that's even truer since Basin and WAPA joined SPP. In any event, we think the PSC needs to signal that it expects MDU, as well as Xcel, Northern States Power, Otter Tail Power, and others to be more aggressive at MISO and in looking at proposals for new transmission spending, since MISO, as we've outlined and you've outlined, not we, you've outlined here, socializes those costs of new transmission lines to all members. And many or most of the projects are for states like Minnesota or others that have aggressive renewable goals that require such transmission spending. And as you are all well aware, I don't have to tell you this, for those listening, North Dakota doesn't have that goal. And we think that we should continue to be vocal in stating it does not benefit from, nor can it afford, such RTO authorized spending at a time like this. And so MDU and the North Dakota utilities in MISO should demand a low growth scenario be performed from MISO. Last, I just want to go back, and I know that they're authorized under statute to allow for surcharges such as the transmission cost adjustment. But as you know from previous comments we've made in rate cases and otherwise, other words, that we're not a fan of these. They often flow almost automatically through qualified spending without the opportunity to offset such spending requests with cost decreases. And these rate mechanisms are harmful to ratepayers, and we think blunt companies' incentives to act aggressively to control such costs. And so, again, I just appreciate the opportunity, and I thank the commission for taking this time. I think it was really important. And we've certainly been continuing to hear from our members and watching closely related to this, and certainly do that. And so, again, thanks for the opportunity to comment. And we encourage you to continue to closely scrutinize this and other measures to avoid such jumps now and in the future.
You know, I'm going to just, thank you, Josh, very much. Appreciate your thoughts. Again, we certainly take them to heart and into consideration. I don't think anyone would argue that that the timing isn't great. Less than ideal would be a good way of putting it. But at the same time, we're also trying to balance not creating a situation of extreme sticker shock down the road either. So it's something that we'll continue to discuss. But one thing about the projects, because I think sometimes when people see transmission projects either tied to costs related to MISO or SPP, being in another part of the country as not benefiting North Dakota ratepayers, but it is an integrated system, of course, and when additions, an MVP project, for example, that originated in Ellendale, went to Big Stone. It was one of the MVP projects. Other states had to pick up the cost of that, a high percentage of that cost as well. So we're trying to create and watch to make sure that it's a fair balance and that these projects, because it is a multi-state integrated system, and I think that's hard for the typical average consumer to really get their arms around. But it's certainly something that we're watching intently at all times. Commissioner Fedorchuk?
Sure. Thank you, Josh. Appreciate you sitting through this morning and also weighing in with your thoughts. I also really appreciate you educating your members and getting ratepayers involved in learning about and caring about and expressing their interest in MDU's operations and business and charges. Couple things just in relation to your comments. So the your mentioning of not supporting customers paying for facilities that aren't fully operational yet. The technical term for what that is the allowance for funds used during construction. It's called AFUDC. I think you probably know that. And that is specifically allowed per the legislature. And so if you don't like that, you should make that known to the legislature because that's a provision that they've provided to the investor-owned utilities in North Dakota. So they are allowed to ask us for recovery of funds while projects are being constructed. They try to match the funds used for that year and come and collect those funds from the customers through the riders. I wholeheartedly agree with you in terms of the future transmission builds with MISO, and I know Randy probably agrees with you from the SPP side. Rest assured, we are working very hard. I probably spend half my time on MISO issues, and there is a lot going on with transmission builds right now, and you're hearing it. A lot of people in North Dakota who support future development of our renewable resources want more transmission, and that has to be balanced very carefully with the recognition, which I have, you know, ingrained in my heart and my brain, that the people paying for that are the ratepayers. We just yesterday had a long meeting with some folks from South Dakota as well, just trying to get our heads together and make sure we have a strong position of to negotiate in MISO and with our fellow colleagues in other states on fair cost allocation for any future transmission builds. And I have strong feelings about that those not be put on the shoulders of North Dakotans unfairly. Also, I hope you heard some of the advantages, and we'll work to recognize those and communicate those, use those in your communications with your members, that there are benefits of being part of these power pools. And this is not something that has been done on a willy-nilly basis. It's something that we look at. It's something the companies look at. And there has been recognition that there is a net significant benefit to customers from being involved in these power pools. You heard Darcy Nigam talk about the fact that if it wasn't for being part of MISO, they would have to have a sizable additional generation resources that they own themselves and that only their customers would pay for. And those are significantly larger requirements for customers than the charges that they pay for transmission services in the power pool. And they also benefit from having the lower market price in the power pool that they're purchasing and reselling in. So that's something we look at, and it isn't, you know, we're not interested in being involved in things that have a high cost for customers without any benefits. we are just the opposite of that. So it's something we pay close attention to and want to make sure that it's of value to the customers that we're representing here. So those are my thoughts. Thank you very much.
Commissioner Crisman, did you have...
Commissioner Fedorchuk, on your last point, we're not suggesting that power pools are not a good thing. We're suggesting that they're in the wrong power pool. So we're not saying RTOs are bad. We're suggesting it's the wrong one.
Yeah, I heard that, and I hope you heard their response to that, too, and that it would be more expensive for them to belong to SPP. So that's something we've evaluated as well, and we'll continue to keep an eye on.
Commissioner Crisman, I see your light is on. Do you have comments?
Yes, sir. And thanks, Josh, for being thorough and getting yourself informed on this topic matter that is not commonly understood because it's so unique. It is helpful to us and to society in general when you help make your members aware of a lot of these things. And I just want to say that another way you can help is, you know, when there are these projects, and a lot of them are important and necessary. Most of them should be built. But I think too often in recent years, our society has gotten to a point where too many leaders look at the utility industry as a sandbox where we can promote economic development and not have to take responsibility for it. And the responsibility ends up being with the utility regulators who have to pass the costs on to the consumers. And that's what we get here. So whether projects are occurring in North Dakota or somewhere else in either SPP or MISO, we need to look at them on the importance that they bring to the reliability and affordability over a long period of time to the electric grid. Not whether it's good economic development for that small area, because as we're seeing in this particular case, those economic development projects, when that's the only reason, while it's nice for the area, it gets spread out and is painful for the ratepayers. So again, appreciate your help on informing people of these things.
Josh, did you have any other thoughts you would like to share?
I just want to close again, Chairman Krosius, Commissioner Fedorchuk, Commissioner Crisman. I want to emphasize, I think it's important what you did today in having this informal hearing and then offering this public input session. And, well, you certainly heard from a couple of folks. I think their points were on point, and I think others are probably listening and paying attention, and I don't think it's any secret that people are paying attention. And so I appreciate you doing your due diligence and really digging into this because it's important, and we'll continue to do what we can and weigh in where it's important to watch out for consumers as well. So thank you again.
Yeah, well, thank you. Appreciate it very much. Okay, now we'll do a quick check to see if anyone is on the phone bridge. So, Matt, you can give instructions.
Hello. If you're called in to the Open Voice Public Bridge and would like to provide some input, dial *9 for a virtual hand raise. Seeing none.
Okay, I don't believe we have anyone on the phone bridge. I had indicated that we might circle back to the company. I don't know if that would be necessary or not, but I'll give the company the opportunity to do a close if they wish, or if they are done presenting, that is fine as well. So anyone from MDU that would like to provide any closing thoughts? Carl, I see you're live.
Yeah, Commissioners, Carl Liebitz here. Maybe a question as to the record. We opened with an informal hearing, and generally that was just parties to the proceeding. And then we took a break and then transitioned to a public input session. I guess our expectation, or was, and maybe Mr. Hsu could weigh in, but our thought is that the informal hearing part of it would be part of the formal record. And then comments from the public, of whom are not parties to the proceeding, would not be part of the formal record. And so that's how we're thinking about it, but welcome input from Mr. Hsu or others. The record would reflect today's buying session, if you will.
Sure. I can speak to generally public input is not part of the electronic record upon which the decision is normally made. However, if the commission would like to move that into the record, they certainly could. I know as it is right now that it's currently being recorded together, so it would require some separation, and that was a bit of an oversight. So I guess I would leave up to the commissioners to make a decision on that.
Do you have thoughts?
Does the company object to it being part of the record?
Yeah, I think, Commissioner, this is Carl again, you know, that members of the public aren't, you know, we don't have an opportunity, obviously, to cross-examine. They're not, you know, sworn in like you would in a hearing environment. You know, no rebuttal testimony, so no outright objections to what was discussed, but it doesn't seem appropriate to have non-party input as a formal part of the record. And that's, I guess, my perspective.
Sure, and I guess to follow up with that, if the commission did like to move it in the record, it would seem appropriate to allow the company an opportunity to file a rebuttal if they so chose.
Commissioner Christman, would you like to weigh in? I see your light is on.
The light being on was an oversight, but I'll say we have to maintain consistency from, you know, one case to another. Can always be exceptions, but generally we try to be consistent, and there'll be future cases that it just might not be a good idea, I think, to start making in the middle of cases public input a part of the official record, just by calling in like this. So I think that this part of it should be kept separate in the public input file in case.
And if I may, there's one additional reason why we may want to separate that into the electronic record and the public input is we have received a number of public inputs outside of the actual oral testimony or oral comments today. We have written comments as well, and those would be getting different treatment from that aspect. So if we would like to maintain consistency with how we treat all public input as you evaluate and make your decision, it probably would not be part of the electronic record.
I would agree with that, having that separation, but including the comments we received from Janet, George, and Josh as a part of the public input that the commission does receive. I think that would be consistent, but keeping the electronic record to the informal hearing itself. One of the thoughts on doing it this way, and we heard it, I think, from several or if not all three people that provided input, that hearing the process, hearing the proceeding was very helpful in them being able to understand what this process is all about. I think otherwise, you know, prior to the process occurring, you get snippets, or the public is provided just a part of the picture, and it's hard for them to appropriately weigh in and really know what's driving this. So this was taking input after I felt a better explanation was provided, and I think we accomplished that as we heard in their comments. Unless there are objections, I think keeping that separate from the official record, but certainly within the public input received, would be appropriate.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with that, and but I just want to make a couple comments if any of the public is still listening. this is where things get more technical and formal mm-hmm. and process-oriented than I think folks in the outside might just view it not as being as common sense. But we are a quasi-judicial body, and we have, you know, pretty formal rules of evidence and legal processes that we have to follow and be consistent with over time. And so, but from the standpoint of public, the public input, I want to assured the public that did participate that your input and the questions that you offered in advance and the input that you provided in writing to us certainly did inform myself and I'm sure my colleagues in the questions that we asked here today, and to that extent is very much a part of the public or the quote-unquote official record. And so it's very helpful to have you involved in your input matters, and whether it's deemed officially part of the record or not, it's still baked in through the questions that we asked and the conversation that we had with the company. So very valuable and important in the end as well. So thank you.
Commissioner Christman, any closing comments?
Nope, that's it.
Okay, well, at this point in time, a number of thank yous, three in particular. One, thank you to those who called in and again, provided comments. Thank you to the company for providing the presentation during the informal portion of the hearing. And I will close that out officially here in just a second, but also thank you to staff. I don't have my official notes, so I'm going to do this from memory. Hopefully I get it right. The audio recording as well as the presentation provided by the company will now be a part of the official record upon which a decision will be made. Are there any objections to that evidence becoming a part of the official record from the company?
No objections. Just clarifying, you know, prior to the break and during the informal session.
Yes, that is correct. The official record will be up to the break and not include the public input portion as mentioned. Staff, any objections?
No objections.
No, I would like to make one point of clarification, though, even though it isn't part of the actual electronic record, part of the legal record, it still will be docketed and available.
Correct. Yes. Yeah, no, it was very important feedback. So, all right, then the audio recording as well as the presentation, the PowerPoint presentation, is now considered evidence and will be used in the making, in the official decision. I want to thank everyone again for their participation. It was about a little over three hours, so we covered a lot of ground, but thank you, everyone. Appreciate it. And the follow-up items, as mentioned, Victor, you had mentioned those earlier. One was, well, there was four, I believe. Can you go through those again?
So we were going to have an alternatives with passing back the under-collected balance over 2 years. Mm-hmm. One alternative where we hold the entirety of that until next year. And then two variations of each of those with implementation. Well, actually, I suppose three variations. Implementation dates, November 1, December 1, and January 1 for each of those, just depending on how long until we get an official decision. And then just kind of as an aside to that, if I could ask the company to specify what the last date that they can receive our approval and be able to implement rates. So, for example, in order to implement as of November 1, what is the last date that you could be that we could approve that for you to implement on November 1? And similarly for December and January as well.
Mr. Chairman, yes. To that point on implementation and kind of the timing of this, which is is somewhat time sensitive in order to mitigate additional rate impacts. Would it be possible or advisable for us to set a work session, like a deadline for the company's exhibits and today set a work session for when we're going to get together and try to wrap this up or talk about it so we can get it on a future meeting agenda?
Yeah, we talked about that. Maybe this is completely unrealistic, but I don't know if it would be possible to have these elements, this probably isn't, but by noon on Tuesday, it's probably a great stretch, but I'm thinking about, short of the timing still being, with the November 1st implementation date, we have one commission meeting coming up next week. Correct. And after that, we have one following on November 11th. So,
would you anticipate getting the filings and having an order ready for Wednesday? Seems a little
tight. It seems really tight, but I'd also prefer not to go to a special meeting. And
I can have an order ready. I mean, that's not going to take me very much time, and then just plug in whatever numbers we come up with. But yeah, to have adequate time for you all to review what the company files, that's kind of the big question mark, I guess. The first question is for the company, how long do they need to file this,
right,
this
right,
information?
Right.
Thanks, Victor. Tuesday at noon would be tight, but I really think it can be done. So we could probably get you that information by Tuesday at noon.
Okay. I mean, we'd have to be able to have a work session scheduled Tuesday afternoon at that point in time to. And again, it is time sensitive. That's the reason. It isn't that this has been predetermined. We still have to talk about it. But sooner, assuming some form of approval, is definitely better for ratepayers. Commissioner Crispin, do you have thoughts?
I can do that if the company and the staff can do that, and then if when we get into a work session to actually discuss it, if we agree that quickly.
Right. I mean, there are a lot of ifs, and it.
We could sure try if the company and staff can be ready for us to have a discussion on Tuesday afternoon. Mm-hmm.
I think the dates of implementation will probably be, in terms of those three scenarios, to me, the two components I'm going to, well, I guess that factors in, but the two components, one would be the potential to either spread the under-recovered balance out over 2 years, or whether or not to defer it until the following year.
Right.
So. Well, let's shoot for that. Keep us posted, Travis. And I know it's a very tight window, and we want it to be right, so, of course. So
I will put a motion on the agenda for this item, just as a placeholder. And then if we don't end up getting to an acceptable order for everyone, we'll just pull it.
Okay.
I'll in the meantime draft up that order and send out kind of that preliminary draft to the three of you, just for the language stuff, if you want to take a look and see if you are okay with all of that, and then I'll modify numbers and things like that based on the work session.
Okay.
Can we set a work session time too?
Yes, I would definitely agree with that. We can certainly go into scheduling, so.
But Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Commissioner. Yes.
Before we do that, if we still have people that haven't worked on these kinds of things in the past that are listening in, this doesn't mean that when we talk about getting an order done and everything, that it's just rubber stamping what MDU had asked for. This is our process because of open records requirements. We can't really just call each other on the phone or something and discuss this case. We need to get all the things, the further information that we've asked for in front of us, and then we'll have this work session, which will be an opportunity where the press or people could be there, and we'll discuss it to get to what we want the order to say. But we need something to start with, and so people should understand that.
Mm-hmm. We could add the order to the agenda when and if we have one. Even
yeah,
if it's late.
Yeah, that's fine.
I think that seems a little premature at this point.
Okay.
But let's still continue without adding it. Continue on having the draft ready would be great. We'll see how the company can progress with some of the information, and then how does 1 or 1:30 work on Tuesday for?
Works for me.
Randy, how does that work for you?
That works for me too, but I will also say that later in the afternoon would also work. And if the company is going to get information in by noon on Tuesday, we might not have had very much opportunity to contemplate it before our work session if we meet at 1. But it's either any time in the afternoon
would
be okay.
I think the numbers will be pretty straightforward. I mean, 2 o'clock, should we just change it a little bit, 2 o'clock?
I'd like to have a little time to review what the company provides just so that we aren't doing that while we're meeting. So 2 or 3, I think, would be great.
Okay, well, to be safe, why don't we just plan on 3 o'clock then? It sounds like that would work for everyone here on staff. So 3 o'clock Tuesday, we'll have a work session on this. On the condition that the company is able to provide the information as quickly as we're hoping, and again recognizing that it's a big request. So, okay, thank you, everyone. I think that's a wrap. So, thanks all.
Thanks.